ran out on the federal eviction
moratorium.
Pelosi is again calling on President Biden to extend the moratorium, but the White House has insisted Congress must take action first. It's another day of delay and frustration for passengers flying on Spirit Airlines. Rory O'Neill reports.
Mass flight cancellations started over the weekend, hitting two Florida airports particularly hard, Fort Lauderdale and Orlando. In each location, dozens of flights were canceled, and frustrated passengers were left to sleep in airport terminals. Unclear what's happening next. Despite rumors of a pilot strike, both Spirit and the pilots' union say that's not true. Spirit blaming cancellations on the weather and what they call operational challenges.
Fewer than 1% of fully vaccinated Americans end up testing positive for COVID-19. That's according to the Kaiser Family Foundation's analysis of breakthrough coronavirus cases that resulted in hospitalization or death. It also found that more than 90% of recent cases and hospitalizations are among those unvaccinated. President Biden will get an update on the coronavirus surge today amid growing concerns about the Delta variant. Biden and Vice President Harris will sit down in a private meeting with members of the White House COVID response team, who will brief reporters later today. Biden has called the latest spike a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Florida is leading the Delta surge. More than 21,000 new cases were reported in the Sunshine State yesterday. You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
Liberty Mutual Insurance Company presents...
And we're back with Limu, Emu, and Doug for the final question. Category is things you climb. All right, Limu, what do you think? You sure? We're going with Liberty Mutual customizes your car insurance so you only pay for what you need. Oh, so close. We were looking for stairs. Huh. Only pay for what you need.
Liberty, Napa know-how.
At Napa, get a $10 gift card when you buy a 5-quart jug of Mobil 1 motor oil for $27.99. A deal so rich, they'll call you an oil tycoon. Yep, with great oil for $27.99 and $10 back, all you'll need is a monocle. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
At participating locations, it's not a good state. That's the result of these. Napa price sales price may not be available in some states. Rebate restrictions apply. Offer ends day 31/21.
And let's go ahead and take a look now to alternative house weather outlook for Monday. Well, we see pretty much clear skies, but some haze. High temperatures on 80, 81 degrees. A little bit of wind out of the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. But for the most part, the haze will hang around for most of the day today. Clear skies and low temperatures dropping down to about 60 for the evening. For Tuesday and for Wednesday, more hazy conditions and high temperatures in the low 80s. With clear skies through the overnight, low temperatures in the low 60s.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Basile and Transformation Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is Dr. John DeMartini. This is one of the most amazing and inspiring shows that you can listen into. If you want to be on the edge of your seats, if you want to open up your heart, if you want to expand your mind, and you want to meet incredible people, stay tuned because you're just about to experience a transformative radio show that will change your life. And you're listening to the Dr. Pat Show is coming up right next.
Welcome to the Dr. Pat Show. Talk radio to thrive by. Powerful, inspiring. And coming to you live, bringing you stories of people like you and me, busting through and living life full out. Get ready to dare to wonder what your life would be like if you knew you could not fail. Hey, everybody. Super welcome. It's great to have all of you tune us in and turn us on. I am so excited about the show today. I'm really thrilled. You know, Scott's going to be joining me here, Scott Creighton, in a hot second. But we're going to be talking about something that's a life's work for him. You know, he is an engineer. He travels. He explores all the sacred sites. He's been on many shows. He's been on my show before, but he's also been on Ancient Aliens, and you've seen him on this show because if you're me, you're trying to understand in your life, what is the relationship that some of us have to Egypt that we don't know about? Clearly, you're looking at things and we all are in awe about certain life events. And today we're going to talk about the Great Pyramid Void Enigma, the mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors with Scott. We're going to be talking about that. And we've got Benny and Jamie. Jamie's probably throwing up some pictures of this. I want everybody to see the book there. I hope I'm in the frame, Jamie. There we go. and I want to just talk about this. When you're a Scott, you have a life that you've dedicated, right? But you also get backlash. You know, he and I could talk, do a whole show on what happens when you get backlash. We're certainly seeing it play out in the Olympics when athletes are getting backlash. What does backlash mean? That means that in your life, you have ideas. And your ideas may not match what the conventional norm is, right? There may be some things that you know that you've investigated that you have where you're just pointing to things that are probably a little bit, how should I say it, outside of the realm. Now, why do I say that? Well, 18 years ago when I decided that we've got to do positive talk radio, we've got to, and, you know, there was one station on the planet that thought that was a good idea. Positive talk radio, what the heck is that? But along the way, you discover things you don't know about what you don't know. Today, we're going to talk about what happens when out of nowhere, there comes the realization of something, the Great Pyramid Boy. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about how Scott leads us through this interesting conversation, even why a pyramid. Scott, it's great to have you. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Pat. It's good to be here again after, I think, about 6 or 7 years. But, yeah.
No, you got to come
back more often. You're looking good.
Yeah, you're looking good, too. Yeah, we're having a moment right here, aren't we? It's so good. Okay, I want to start out with a really odd question. I've been getting ready for the show and I'm reading the book. And I'm thinking to myself, and I'm looking at my home, and if you look at my home, you see artifacts in my home that are just a little bit unusual based on how people know me, and they comment about this. But here we are today. You have dedicated yourself to this. You have talked about this. We're talking about the big void today, but I want to ask you this question. You know, what is it about your journey, the knowing that you've had, that has brought you the most criticism in presenting your ideas?
Oh, gosh. Where do I begin?
I love this question.
Yeah, that's not an odd question at all. It's a very pertinent and prescient question, to be honest, because there isn't really a day that goes by where, you know, my thoughts and ideas, views, opinions are attacked. And why do people feel that they need to always go on the attack? That really mystifies me personally. But, you know, I kind of have changed my sort of thinking over the years, because when people used to give me a lot of flack and used to attack my ideas, my theories, I used to knee-jerk myself and try automatically to defend everything, that every single word that I said, or so I could defend it. I realized that actually that's pointless, because the people that generally are giving you the flack and they're attacking you aren't interested in what you have to say anyway. So I soon realized that, well, you know, there's no point in me even trying to, you know, convert you around or whatever, because that's it. These people that attack my opinions, so I'm not insisting that what I am saying is the real deal, this is as you have to believe this. Absolutely not. And I would never do that. I put it out there for people to, you know, it's an idea, it's an opinion, you know, to contemplate over it, to think about it, does this make sense to you? But the people that go on the attack, they're not interested in having their mind expanded, really. They just seem set in their ways, and, you know, the way it's been is the way it always will be. You know, I kind of liken it to evolution in a sort of way, where you have, you know, these ecosystems and you know, you have these ecological niches where a particular species will defend itself to the death and prevent any new competitors coming into that space.
Yes.
Well, to me, that is a bit like Egyptology, you know, and the guardians, they are the guardians, the custodians of, you know, our ancient history and prehistory up to a point, particularly from my point of view when it comes to the Great Pyramids. They are prehistorical, not historical monuments. Anyway, they are the custodians of that, and they will, you know, defend and defend and defend their little niche of historical niche. So only in time when the evidence becomes overwhelming, when the competition becomes too great, will they be removed and replaced within that niche. So that's kind of how I see it now. It's a longer game that they have to play, basically, you know.
Yeah. So. And the reason I wanted to ask you that question, because I really want to dig deep into this now, because in your book, I'm telling you, I love diagrams, right? I love to connect the dots. And what's so brilliant about this, and we're going to explain to people what this is, what the void is, but also from your perspective, the mysteries of the Hall of the Ancestors. And the reason I love this is you have done some beautiful detective work in the book to help us connect the dots. It's not just a conversation about these are the pyramids, this is this. But what you do is you go through the legends of this and you explore, you know, for us thousands of years, right? And you put together science, you put together esoteric traditions, and you present something to us, which is really what I love in the detective work you do. But for people that are not familiar with what we're talking about, let's give them a sneak peek. If you're thinking about, Scott, you're thinking about what has been built here, let's just start with the conversation about the pyramids, because many people know of them. They know about, they exist, and they know that they're one of the most studied archaeological aspects of who we are and what we do, except for the people that are trying to find Atlantis. But we are looking at these pyramids, and we have been in awe of them. Tell us about the awe we have and, you know, what we're talking about when we're talking about Egyptian legend.
Yeah. Well, as you know, Dr. Pat, all of us from our junior school have been taught that the pyramids were the tombs of the pharaohs and that the tomb was the structure, if you like, the machine, if you like, that allowed the pharaoh to ascend to the afterlife. That is what you're taught at school. Now, I remember being at school, and I must have been a nerd or something, or a geek or something at school, you know, because all the other sort of kids were interested in dinosaurs and blood and all that kind of stuff. I was fascinated with the pyramids, always have been. I just could not get my head round, because I saw from a very young age just how vast the Great Pyramid was. You know, it's absolutely enormous, nearly 500 feet high, you know, and about 750 feet wide. You know, so I'm looking at this thing and I'm thinking, why did they build that for just one guy as his eternal tomb? Because, you know, that thing could be seen, you know, if they built that to protect his body, it could be seen from like 40 miles away.
Yeah.
You know, so that didn't make any sense to me.
Right.
You know, why would they do that? Because it's about protecting the king's body, just as, you know, anyway, that really didn't make sense, because they have these passages that basically lead directly to the so-called burial chamber. So it made no sense to me whatsoever.
Not very protected.
Not at all. I mean, you know.
So there's a disconnect.
Yeah, totally. The pyramid, the lower chamber of the Great Pyramid has always been accessible since it was built. Has always been accessible. Now, why would a king even permit that to happen? He just would not do that. You know, so you find all these anomalies. You know, as you get older and you start investigating, you find all these anomalies about the internal architecture of the Great Pyramid. But then as well, you know, I started researching about the legends of the pyramids. Because what these legends tell us is a completely different story as to why they were built from what we were taught at school. Now, these legends come from the ancient Egyptians themselves, or rather their descendants. The Coptic Egyptians, who represent about 10% of the modern Egyptian population today, they held on to these traditions for thousands of years. And they tell us and themselves that they are the custodians of the ancient Egyptian civilization and that they preserve the cultural heritage of the ancient Egyptian civilization. Now, these were oral traditions that were passed down by the Coptic Egyptians, which is kind of strange because ancient Egypt was one of the world's first literate societies. So why would the Coptic Egyptians revert to an oral tradition? Well, the reason for that, there's a Coptic Egyptian professor, Fatin Gerges, who tells us, she did a brilliant dissertation paper for her doctorate, and she tells us that, well, the Egyptian civilization was invaded three times in antiquity by the Macedonians, the Romans, and latterly the Arabs. And all these consequences, you know, they were brutal persecutions, basically, and they were not allowed to have any of their history, their written history. It was all destroyed. So they had to revert to the oral tradition to preserve their history. And one of the legends that they preserved is the legend of Saurid, or Surid. Now, he was the king of ancient Egypt, whom the Coptic Egyptian legend tells us built the Great Pyramids. Now, the name Surid is actually, the scholar Sander Fodor tells us, is merely a corruption of the name Sufis. It's a corruption of the name Sufis. If you look at the Greek name Sufis and the Greek name Surid, they're very close. So it's probably a transcription error. So the name Sufis is really the name they're talking about, and we know that Sufis translates into Egyptian Khufu. So this is where we're at. The Coptic legends tell us that Saurid Khufu built the Great Pyramid not as his tomb, but as... basically, what happened was, the legend tells us that he saw something changing in the heavens. And he asked his astronomer priests at the time, what does this mean? And they told him, it means in about 300 years' time, there will be a great deluge that will destroy the entire kingdom. Everything will be destroyed. So Khufu then decided that what he would do was to build these man-made mountains that we know as pyramids, and into which he would place everything that the kingdom would need afterwards to reboot itself, essentially. Inside these the chambers within these monuments, now he built about 16 of these, okay, and this number 16 pyramids, which I explain in the book as well, is allegorical to the 16 pieces of Osiris. Osiris's body was cut into 16 pieces scattered across the land of Egypt. Now, the pyramid texts tell us that Osiris is the pyramid is Osiris, and there's just 16 pieces of the legend of Osiris. So, these 16 pyramids were essentially vaults or arcs. And if you look at the early Christian tradition, you know, the homilies, of, you know, we know of the origins homilies, they tell us that the pyramid, that the ark was shaped as a pyramid. You know, so, and there's some depictions in medieval art of the ark as a pyramid with all these animals coming out of it. You know, so we have this ancient tradition that goes back that the pyramids were essentially arcs, and that is what the legend of Surat essentially tells us, that he was building arcs so that his kingdom, after the worst effects of this flood had abated, that the kingdom would be able to recover, would be able to reboot itself. They are recovery vaults. That's what I call them.
Wow. This is so fascinating. But, you know, one of the things, too, that I'm really struck by and the way you describe this, Scott, in the book is, I mean, you don't leave much out. You even talk about the fact that the Great Pyramid of Giza, you even talk about the electromagnetic energy through the hidden. Okay, so this is where I get, like, super, like, excited about it. Electromagnetic energy in the hidden chambers. Now, this has been, you know, a headline that has come out since 2018. You know, and there is a perception in mainstream of view of the pyramids, which you're talking about and helping us understand. But yet we know, maybe let me just generalize for a moment. I don't like doing that, but I like to generalize on this. I'm not sure there are many people that have heard about the pyramids or even seen pictures are not in awe. And I don't just mean awe in a logical way, but there's something so esoteric about the awe. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, yes, if you're an architect, you're like, ooh, this is like architecturally. If you're an archaeologist, then there's like an awe. But there's another awe. There's a collective awe that there's something greater than a bunch of
stones
being piled together. I want to talk about that in the context of how wrong the mainstream view is, but also how right the mainstream sense is. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. This feeling, I mean, I've been to Giza and, you know, and the Great Pyramid several times, and the sense that you get when you were talking earlier, Dr. Pat, you were talking earlier about people, you know, looking for a sense of identity of you know, at a personal level in their lives, and who they are. You know, they'll maybe research their ancestors, their roots a little bit, but they can only get so far. But they feel there's something more to them, you know, searching their own ancestry. And, you know, they want to connect to something. Well, I feel the same thing with history. You know, I look at these structures and I just get a sense of ancientness of the place. And that, in a sense, that takes me back to the ancient roots of mankind in general, not just me as an individual. It connects me to our ancient past, you know, as a human species. You know, this is us, you know, from way, way, way back. You know, so in a sense, you know, when I'm at those monuments, I feel connected to some, you know, ancient roots, if I can maybe put it like that. It's just that gives me a sort of inner sense of connectedness when I'm at those monuments. It's just, I don't know if I'm articulating this particularly well.
No, it's exactly right. But the reason I want to ask that question, and I want to talk about how we get to not only the many, many things you've done and written about this and talked about, but this particular book, because when I think about this discovery, and I'm talking about the Great Pyramid Void, we're going to get to that now, right?
Yeah.
The enigma of that, even for those of us that briefly have a sense of anything about this, it's like a what? You know, we're like, what? But people, the scientists, you, right, your body of work, your lifetime, you're like me. You're like, what about this? I want to do this. Benny, we have 3 copies of The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of Ancestors, and, you know, this is as we're talking about this, this is a book we'd like to give away, 3 copies. I'd love to do that now as Scott and I are going to continue to chat. 1-800-930-2819. And I know Jamie's putting up pictures on Facebook. There it is. Love it. Scott, how do people find out about you? Let's get everybody to find out about you, because we're just talking about one aspect of Scott, but there's like a lot of aspects of Scott.
Okay, well, my publisher, I'm sure you know, is Inner Traditions and Fair and Company. So I've got a sort of holding page there on Inner Traditions website where people can find out a little bit more about myself and my books. You know, I always like to ask people to support their local bookstores. So if you can do that, do that. I have an online forum on, I don't know if I'm allowed to say the name. I can say ATS.
You can say the name.
Yeah, abovetopsecret.com. I've got the alternative Egyptology forum on there. So people are welcome to pop in, you know, start a topic, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
And please go ahead and take a look at this. All right. There is, in this void, there is, how should I say it? When I take the information about what everyone was just in, like, we didn't see this coming. Talk about for a minute, and then we'll connect the dots, you know, as we talk about the King's Chamber, and also we talk about the angle of certain things. But this was like one of these events, Scott, right, where all of you are like, what? Can you talk about the surprise of the void and what this has come to mean now?
Well, yeah. You see, the thing is, when you look at the very first pyramids, first 1620 or so pyramids, what you find is that there's between one and, say, a maximum of 3 chambers. That's it. Most of them have maybe 1-2 chambers, most of them. Some of them have I think, like the red pyramid and the bent pyramid have 3 chambers. And these can all be more or less explained in terms of conventional, all these different chambers and purposes can be more or less explained. Obviously, one of them is the burial chamber, the so-called burial chamber. But then we have the Great Pyramid, which has this massive chamber called the Grand Gallery, a fourth chamber. And to be honest, Egyptologists today, I mean, they've known about that chamber forever, you know, well, since at least, Al-Mamun broke in about 820 AD. So they've known about that for about 1,200 years, but they've never really been able to explain it. Terms of their Egyptological understanding. It's just there, and they call it some grand processional chamber or, you know, something like that. They don't really know how that chamber fits in. That's 4 chambers in the Great Pyramid. So already the Great Pyramid is slightly cast adrift from all the other pyramids that have come before. And now we find potentially another massive chamber the same size as the Grand Gallery. Now, just to let your listeners understand, Dr. Pact, the Grand Gallery is about 10 feet wide, 30 feet high, and about 100 feet long.
Yeah, it's shocking to even think about this for me. This is like totally mind-blowing.
Yeah, and that's the fourth chamber in the Great Pyramid. It's massive, absolutely massive. And now what the Scanned Pyramids team have discovered is a chamber or a space, a big void. They're not calling it a chamber yet because, well, they've never been in there yet. So they're playing with semantics, really, my opinion. You know, so there's this massive space that they've now found. It's as big as the Grand Gallery, and that's the fifth chamber. You know, so it's just completely throwing everything, you know, up in the air.
Yeah, and let's talk about what it throws up in the air. It throws up some conceptual ideas that previous discoveries and previous people that have discoveries and the way they're connecting the dots. I could spend a lifetime just reading one of your articles, right, and trying to interpret the impact, because it's so massive to me when you have hundreds of years of people and discoveries, right? People that have been in there that have discovered things. You know, I think about, you know, Gilbert and, you know, those folks that really just, you know, investigated and found things. Here's my question. Even though we can't call it a chamber, we know it's big, right? Somehow our science has made us discover things. We know it's big. Here's my question. I'm gonna ask you to go out on a limb if you could. Does this discovery in your, Scott, your perspective, is it going to blow previous analysis out of the water? And what I mean by that is we're looking at connections and we're looking at the Great Pyramid Enigma. We're also looking at the King's Chamber. We're looking at the King's Chamber, the Queen's Chamber. We're looking at trajectories. We're looking at Orion. We're looking at these connections, which are just absolutely stunning when you look at them and the connection. And you're thinking to yourself, future Hollywood person created a movie and the Great Pyramid's a movie. And it's not. This was created by, you can decide if humans created it or not. That's another show you and I can do on that, because I'm telling you, I don't know any human that could create this. I, you know, maybe there is some. Maybe, I don't know, Einstein's dead, but maybe he come back. But I don't know any human. Maybe Elon Musk, I don't know. Maybe you could create it. But can you help me understand how this new discovery may alter evidence that has come before?
Yeah, well, it's kind of slowly already starting to do that. However, if they do find a means to gain access, and I've heard from a source that they are trying to drill into that space, when they get in there, and if they find in there what I suspect they will find in there, then it is going to change the paradigm completely and overnight, in my opinion, because it will prove, if they find in this chamber what I suspect will find in this chamber, because what I suspect to find, it's not me saying this, it's the Coptic Egyptian legend that's telling us what's in this chamber.
Exactly.
It's not me saying this. So if they find in there, if they start listening to the Coptic Egyptian people and what they're saying, and rather instead of believing what, you know, some person made up a couple of hundred years ago,
yep,
you know, and start properly listening to what,
yep,
these people are saying, then, you know, it's really going to come as a big shock to them. And it's going to change,
yep,
things overnight. It,
yep,
really is.
I agree with you. I so agree with you that I can't wait till they put the Dead Sea Scrolls together, because, you know, we're talking about, if we really pay attention, right, of what was said, it will change not only our perspective. Now, look, we've got Bob calling in from Australia. Let's go to Bob. Bob's question, Benny, if we could.
Welcome to the show, Bob.
Hey, Bob, you're live.
Hey.
Hey, how are
you
today?
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Beautifully. Question we got for Scott,
yeah,
right?
There's a bit of a delay because I'm in the Whitsunday Islands in Australia. Yeah, Scott, I've been fascinated by the pyramids ever since I was a young fellow, and I'm 68 now. And I went there in 74 and just wandering, you know, through the area like that, hairs on the back of my neck standing up, and the same energy that I felt as Stonehenge. But I came across a guy, Hakim Aliam, who was a Sufi elder, who did some great presentations on the purpose and history of the pyramids. And, you know, what's coming to light now is just amazing. For me, as an engineer, trained as an engineer, for me, it's obvious what they were. You know, they are energy generators connected through a global grid to other megalithic structures around the planet. And even the walls in the great chambers, when they opened them up, they were all blackened as if there'd been some great sort of energy happening there, some sort of fusion or vision, I don't know. The Egyptian, you know, the Egyptologists at the time cleaned all that muck off the walls. It's just another way of hiding the truth. But I love the way the truth is now coming out, you know. And it's so obvious that the pyramids, they say, you know, were built about 2,500-3,000 years BC. But no, I reckon they just had a makeover, you know. They just had a bit of a refurbishment. I would so love for us to be able to re-energize the pyramids. That would be my goal. I'd love to see that happen.
Wow, Scott. Are we getting closer to doing that?
Well, as I said, my source at the moment tells me that, you know, there's scientists up there in Campbell's Chamber, which is way, way, way above the King's Chamber. It's that sort of chamber with the sort of inverted V roof, the vaulted roof. And from what I've been told, and it's not official, it's not, you know, but my source tells me that they're currently drilling a small hole through the vaulted roof up in Campbell's Chamber to push an endoscopic camera through the hole into the big void space to try and have an initial look around.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the thing about the big void space, Dr. Pat, is that there's absolutely no passageways to it. There's no tunnels or passageways or anything. It's just sitting there completely isolated from the rest of the pyramids. And that's the other thing that kind of makes the Egyptologists think, well, hey, that can't be a chamber, because there's no passages to it. You know, no, it is a chamber and it serves a very, very specific function. But, you know, regarding Bob's ideas, I mean, I've heard these ideas about, you know, the energy grid and so forth and so on. You know, I think, you know, Graham Hancock talks about this a lot, that there was, you know, a pre-Ice Age civilization that understood a lot about our planet and, you know, basically, you know, they could, you know, travel across our planet. You know, they could go to the Americas, they could go to Egypt, they could go to Stonehenge, they could go to all these places around the world. You know, they mapped the world. We've got ancient maps, you know, from ancient times, you know, when, you know, the longitude wasn't known. And, you know, these maps have the longitude on them, which, you know, we didn't discover until John Harrison, you know, invented a timepiece that was accurate enough for us to use longitude. So, but here it is in these ancient maps. You're like, there has to have been an ancient civil, and these maps are using other ancient source maps that have since disappeared. Probably when the Library of Alexandria was burned down, a whole lot of stuff disappeared. But, you know, so this idea that, you know, this civilization, you know, you know, we do know that there are energy lines, there are ley lines. You know, there's a ton of evidence about this. Is that why they selected that particular location in Egypt to build the pyramids? I don't know. Maybe that is one of the reasons. But it is an absolute fact. You know, there's been scientific studies done that... So I think the Times article in 2018 shows that the Great Pyramid, or the pyramid shape, focuses, but particularly the Great Pyramid focuses electromagnetic energy into the chambers. You know, its design focuses energy, electromagnetic energy, into the actual chambers. Now, the thing about, and here's the other interesting thing about electromagnetism, it slows down decay. Electromagnetism slows down decay. And I've done all sorts of experiments. I think I've got one experiment in the book, the milk experiment. I'm not sure if you read that, Dr. Pat, but
yeah.
You know, it shows they did tests with pyramids, you know, and placed an eight-sided pyramid over, you know, one beaker of milk and a four-sided pyramid and different types of pyramids. And they left a, you know, a sort of test pyramid with, you know, a test beaker with no pyramid. You know, and the eight-sided pyramid, you know, preserved the milk the longest and stopped it decaying the most over time. You know, and here we have the Great Pyramid as an eight-sided pyramid.
Yeah.
An eight-sided pyramid. You know, so it's fascinating to me that that particular shape can minimize decay. And if you've got a lot of bodies in there that you do not want to decay, and this goes back to the ancient Egyptian religion, then, you know, an eight-sided pyramid is the thing you're going to need.
Yeah.
For that electromagnetism to prevent that decay.
Yeah, and, you know, you're absolutely, I mean, you know, what you're talking, and yes, I've read that book. I've read that your experiment on that, which is totally fascinating to me, but you always have to get to the next place, Scott, you know, and this is what I love, is we get to the next place where we start to ask questions that only human beings could ask. Why? How? And if you go to the why, and I love this about the enigma that you're presenting, the Great Pyramid Void Enigma, the mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors, right, Scott? I'm going to hold the book up, but I'm sure, you know, I think this is one of the few shows I do where I take no breaks because I want to talk with you. And thank you for referencing, you know, the idea of, you know, Giza as sort of a power plant, sort of the references of this. But one of the things you talk about in the book, in the diagrams that I love you talk about in the book, is you bring us on the journey where we're looking at a line, we're looking at maybe a set of relationships, G1, G2, G3, Orion's belt. We're looking at some things that are so precise in their determination, so precise that people, like, we can map these things out, right? That we can see this. And it's fascinating about these events. Talk from your perspective and what you've got in the book. Will we get clarity from this new void? Will we get clarity from this new void, or... See, because I don't think we're done yet. I think there's a whole lot more going on in the Great Pyramid. I know, just me. I'm not you. I don't study this for, like, a living. I don't, you know. But my sense is there's a lot more.
Well,
do you think we'll get a sense of clarity from this, or will we have to rethink some things, Scott?
Well, in a sense, Dr. Parks, I hope we don't get clarity.
Yeah.
because everyone loves a mystery, you know. And, you know, I will probably get attacked even more for taking all the mystery out of things, you know. So,
yeah, me too. I'm with you on that.
You know, so it's a kind of, you know, a double-edged sword in a sense. But clarity, I think, if we accept what the Coptic Egyptian legends tell us about these structures, we already have clarity.
Yeah,
it's
we
there.
Do.
Mm-hmm. It's there. It's right in their texts why they built, or their ancestors built, these pyramids. And, you know, if you look at their religion, the king was more important in the ancient Egyptian religion in death than he was in life. Because in death, the king could intercede with the gods. He could commune with the gods to ensure that the Nile would flow, the sun would rise, the crops would grow, the winds would blow, and so on and so forth. That was the job of the dead kings, the Osiris kings. And this is why the mummification had to be so perfect with these dead kings, the Osiris kings, because if their body decayed, then the king's soul, which would go out during the day and then come back to its eternal roost at night and re-enter the body of the king. If the king's body decayed so much, the soul wouldn't be able to recognize the body.
Mm.
And that would mean that king would die forever. He could no longer commune with the gods. And the potential of that happened with every ancestor, then it could be absolute chaos in Egypt. The sun wouldn't rise and, you know, the kingdom would just die. So that is what they believed, and that is why mummification was so crucial, and, you know, preventing decay was so crucial to, you know, the ancient Egyptians, or what I call the pre-ancient Egyptians.
Yeah.
Because I believe this goes way, way back, way, way before 2500 BC.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, because that's really, you know, one of the premises of your work is that it goes way back before that.
Oh, yeah, right? Absolutely. Totally does. There's absolutely no way that those pyramids were built in 2500 BC, in my opinion. I think Bob... from Australia, I think Bob's right in saying that they're basically a makeover in 2500 BC. I know they were a makeover in BC in, at that time, 2500 BC, because the painted marks that Colonel Weiss found in the chambers, in my opinion, he copied those marks from stones that were repaired on that monument in 2500 BC. How do I know that? Because the orthography of the text, of the writing, is completely anachronistic to the supposed time of 2500 BC. The orthography of those maps is from a much later period in ancient Egyptian history. It just, so Colonel Weiss, yeah, he thought they were just... hieroglyphics. So he copied them into these chambers, thinking all hieroglyphics are the same. Well, we now know they're not.
Yeah.
And they're from different periods. And that was his big mistake, and I explained that.
You explain it really interestingly in the book. Now, I was looking at the way you explain it in the book, and I thought to myself, oh, my gosh, what is the impact of that?
Yeah.
It is a major impact.
It's a seriously major impact, because what Colonel Weiss did was he essentially placed false evidence into these monuments, which basically the Egyptology were... They're trundling along, doing a fairly good job, you know, interpreting the hieroglyphics, Champollion and so forth, doing a reasonably good job, Petrie, you know, investigating, measuring and so forth and so on. And then they were thrown a curveball by Colonel Weiss, placing this false evidence, which forced Egyptology, in my opinion, down the wrong path. Had he not done what he did, I believe that the Coptic Egyptian narratives that we have may have been given a more thorough hearing than it has. But because, essentially, Colonel Weiss's actions essentially solidified the Tomb of the Pharaoh paradigm in the heads of the Egyptologists, it essentially stymied their thinking. They thought, well, right, that's it. You know, it's a done deal now. Well, they're fake. Those marks, in my opinion, I present a ton of evidence, not just in this book, Dr. Pat, but I've done a whole book. The Great Pyramid Hoax, my previous book, has got a ton of evidence, new evidence that's never before been seen to show that those marks. I mean, I even found Colonel Weiss's handwritten diaries, his field notes from his time in Egypt in 1837, and they give, you know, a different story to what his published account gives us, a completely different story. So,
are we going to get back on track, though, Scott? Because I agree with you, because are we going to get back on track with looking at what he did and changing our paradigm? And what do I mean by getting back on track? That false, I don't even know what to call it, documentation. Let me call it documentation for lack of a better word. We have to really then go back and say this, take it out, and now what do we have? I mean, are we doing that? And what I mean by back on track is back on track to remove something that was falsified and now look with a different lens. You know, are we doing that now, or are we still holding on to this information that may not be true at all?
Yeah, well, we're not doing it yet, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, my book, my last couple of books, are just one small step to doing that, you know, to taking us out of this current mainstream paradigm, tune of the king, tune of the pharaoh paradigm. Mm. You know, this very simplistic idea. We're a long way from shifting that paradigm, and it's going to take, I think, a lot more evidence. I think when they find what's in the big void, that may help shift things a little bit, but I think, yep. I suspect all it'll do, if they find what I believe they'll find in there, Egyptologists will find a way to just simply shift the goalposts, you know, to say, well, yes, it fits into the paradigm because of, you know, this, or this. They'll just move the goalposts to embrace what I believe they'll find there, you know, so...
It's a gigantic chamber, though.
Yeah, it's
I mean, you know, do you have to ask yourself the question, if you're like me, a lay person, do you have to ask yourself this lay person type question? What purpose does it serve? It's got to have a purpose.
Yeah.
It can't be just a, quote, void. You know, I mean, yeah. Even though we'd like to say, blah, 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 really nothing, it's just a big, I don't know, don't call it a chamber. I don't know what you want to call it. I just call it a big void. You know, the fact that it's a big void, you know, it just raises so many more questions to laypersons like me.
Yeah, well, Dr. Hawass, Zahi Hawass, whom I know you've probably heard of, and Mark Lehner, the American Egyptologist, they basically, their initial reaction was, oh, the Great Pyramid's filled with these voids. You know, there's, you know, nothing to see here, folks. You know, move along. You know, it's the Great Pyramid is peppered with these voids. But, well, actually, no, it's not, because the way the scan pyramid, the muon tomography, this is the science that they use to scan the pyramid, the way it works, if the pyramid is peppered with voids like Swiss cheese, and they would be aggregated out. They take an average, and all these small voids would just be aggregated out. The technology wouldn't see anything. It only sees big spaces. That's
right.
How the technology works. So Dr. Hawass and Lehner, now I know for a fact, have changed their tune a little bit. They are now saying, well, you know, we think we may find something significant in there. They're now changing, or starting to kind of come around to the idea of what this... So I'm hoping maybe they've read some of my articles and my book, but
send it to them again, right? You know, I don't think there are mistakes. You know, in the universe that I live in, I really don't think there are mistakes. I don't believe in a laws of the universe. I don't even like the word mistakes. I don't think that... I mean, I was talking about it from the Olympics this morning in doing a show. I don't think that there are things that happen that are mistaken. I think there are things that happen to help us connect the dots to get to the bottom line of something, whether it's our personal lives, you know.
Yeah.
I look at my own life, and I don't think that losing my job after 25 years was a mistake. I think it was a cosmic rearrangement, you know, for me to get some knowledge and wisdom and do what I was meant to do. But you will keep presenting these things, and you have presented so much evidence in this book. I'm so fascinated by it. I want to make sure folks know, and I know Jamie is making sure people know, I want to make sure they know this is the book. We've given away several copies of it. How do people, again, find out more about you? Because, you know, you're writing articles. I'm reading them. Tell folks how they can get more information about you and sort of join, you know, the conversation with you.
Yeah. Okay, well, as I said, you know, they can write to me via the publisher in their suggestions. They can write to me via the publisher. They can, as I said earlier, they can go onto my web forum. They go to the main page of abovetopsecret.com, and they just scroll down. They'll find the Scott Crichton forum. Probably two-thirds of the way down. So they can scroll down, click on that, and they'll see a whole bunch of material that I've written there over, I think, since about 2007, about 14 years worth of material in there. They can start a topic of their own if they like. There's a whole bunch of articles on there just now about my new book, that they can go and read about, a lot of sneak previews of it and so forth that they can go and read up on. I just finished yesterday, the author of the month on the Graham Hancock forum. We can go on there and, read what I've got to say there. So, but if they want to speak to me directly, go on to ATS and, start a topic, or if there's a topic there, just, pop a post in there, I'll have a look at it and then give you a response.
And by the way, there are many books by Scott that you can get a hold of. There are so many. I think I've interviewed him on a couple of them, on everything from The Secret Chamber of Osiris, Giza Prophecy, so much here talking about the Orion Code. And, you're going to love when you pick up one of Scott's books, you think you're going to read a bunch of words. Of course, there are the words, but you're going to see how things are connected, how the dots are connected, how there are ways that we can look at a sense of understanding, especially if there is this evidence and science that Scott's creating. Scott, thank you so much for today. A couple minutes left. I want to know, what do you want to leave us with? What haven't we talked about that, you want to share with us about these discoveries now?
Oh, gosh, that's a toughie. I'm still continue to do research. I've got a couple of things that I want to do. I hope to go back to Egypt sometime, but that may be problematic because it seems that these days anyone with alternative ideas is no longer being permitted onto these ancient sites. Which is enough of a disgrace, but anyway, that's just life, I suppose. I would like to, just keep digging and keep researching for answers. That's what I do. I do not insist at all that I'm right. It's just ideas, it's just opinions. But as you said, Dr. Pat, I do try to connect everything, and I always provide evidence of some kind, whether it's direct evidence or circumstantial evidence, to back up what it is I'm saying. So it's not just, thrown out there as complete speculation. I always try to back up what I say, and that's what I hope to continue to do.
Absolutely. Scott, thank you so much for today. Thank you for everything you're doing. It's great to see you again.
You too, Dr. Pat, and I hope it's not too long till next time.
I hope so as well. Can't wait to see what the next discoveries are, folks, with this. And we are calling it the Great Void until we can call it a chamber. Let's figure it's a big, place. It's a big space. It's a lot of square footage. Have you calculated square footage? Right, it's like 30 by 100.
30 by 100 by 10, so 10 times 30 is 300 times 400.
Like a giant house.
Massive, absolutely massive, absolutely massive.
Oh my gosh, let's take a short break, everybody. We'll be right back.
On this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
And good Monday to you, Benny Mathers here for a look at your alternative talk AM 1150 traffic update. But round this down, well, so far, no major blocking or accidents to report at the moment. Still 405 northbound, southbound, and northeast 30th Street in the Kennedale Hill area. Stop and go issues in both directions, but everywhere else, traffic's actually looking pretty good. Enjoy your Monday. Stay tuned. Coming up next, after the news and weather, it's another hour of the Transformation Talk Radio Network, the Dr. Pat Show, Talk Radio to Thrive By, and When Bad Teams Happen to Good People. Special guest, Dr. Valerie Patrick.
NBC News Radio, I'm Lisa Taylor. President Biden is getting an update on the surge in COVID cases today as concerns about the Delta variant grow. Biden and Vice President Harris will sit down in a private meeting with members of the White House COVID response team, who will brief reporters later today. Biden has called the latest spike a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Senators are diving into the massive bipartisan infrastructure bill this week.
I hope we can use our time in the Senate efficiently. The longer it takes to finish the bill, the longer we'll be here.
Democratic leader Chuck Schumer says there will be numerous debates and votes on amendments to the roughly $1 trillion plan to upgrade highways, bridges, public transit, water systems, and broadband access. The bill that was crafted by a group of Democrats and Republicans runs nearly 3,000 pages. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says they face an acute challenge at the U.S. southern border. Mayorkas said the Trump administration made it more difficult to address the surge of migrants coming to the U.S.
We are following an administration that frankly dismantled our capabilities to address it, and so we are building it from the ground up.
Mayorkas insisted it's a dynamic situation as they continue to reunite families separated at the border during the previous administration. A new pandemic record is being set for folks being screened at the nation's airports. The TSA says more than 2.2 million went through security checkpoints Sunday. Airport screenings have consistently been above 2 million on many days during the summer travel season. Construction spending figures are up a bit for June. The Commerce Department reports a 0.1% monthly increase, which is less than expected. Building industry analysts had forecast a larger rebound after May's decline. Jessica Springsteen is getting ready for her Olympic debut. The equestrian daughter of New Jersey icon Bruce Springsteen will take part in the individual jumping round at the Tokyo Olympics. She and her horse will take on a course of 12 to 14 obstacles that are 4 feet 7 inches to 5 feet 4 inches tall. Springsteen was named to the U.S. jumping team after strong results during competition recently in Florida. You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
If you're a diabetic, we have great news. You can end the painful finger sticks with a new CGM. Plus, they may be covered by Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance. If you test and inject daily, you may qualify. Call U.S. Med now to learn more.
800-426-0557. 800-426-0557. 800-426-0557. That's 800-426-0557.
And let's go ahead and take a look now to alternative talk weather outlook for Monday. Well, we'll see pretty much clear skies, but some haze. High temperatures on 80, 81 degrees. A little bit of wind out of the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. But for the most part, the haze will hang around for most of the day today. Clear skies and low temperatures dropping down to about 60 for the evening. For Tuesday and for Wednesday, more hazy conditions and high temperatures in the low 80s. With clear skies through the overnight, low temperatures in the low 60s.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat McPhilly and Transformation Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is Dr. John DeMartini. This is one of the most amazing and inspiring shows that you can listen into. If you want to be on the edge of your seats, if you want to open up your heart, if you want to expand your mind, and you want to meet incredible people, stay tuned because you're just about to experience a transformative radio show that will change your life. And you're listening to the Dr. Pat Show is coming up right next to you.
Welcome to the Dr. Pat Show. Talk radio to thrive by. Powerful, inspiring, and coming to you live, bringing you stories of people like you and me, busting through and living life full out. Get ready to dare to wonder what your life would be like if you knew you could not fail. Hey, everybody, welcome. I'm just really excited about this next conversation. I don't even know where to begin. Let me just begin by introducing my guest and author, Dr. Valerie Patrick, the author of When Bad Teams Happen to Good People, Your Complete Repair Guide for Successful Teamwork. I hope she sends this to a couple of Olympic teams. There we go, right there. There's the book. And as I was reading through the book, and I was just thinking about her work, right? Facilitator, leadership trainer, professional speaker, and she just nails it. You know, look, this is somebody that if we were in the workplace together, I was her administrative executive director as she was the engineer, and we were writing all these ridiculous policies and all this stuff on teams and team approaches and getting everybody assessed, like, are you an INTJ? Or, and then taking the other lifestyle assessment and then looking at that and then putting the team together. And if you're me, your boss walks up to you and says, there's no way you can lead the team as an INFP. And I'm like, what? But you're laughing because you know, right? Dr. Valerie Patrick's joining me here today because somebody has to write this book. Somebody has to write this book. I was reading this today. Well, first, let me welcome you to the show before I get off on this. Welcome.
Thank you, Dr. I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
I'm excited to be here. Look at. Okay, I got to hold this up. Hold on. Nobody's going to be able to read it, but I got to hold it up anyway.
All right.
Hello, U.S. Olympic teams. Read this section of her book, Emotional Well-Being. Just read that alone.
Uh-huh.
Look, I want to start with this, with the question.
Okay.
I'm not sure I know anybody that doesn't fit the title of your book. When bad teams happen to good people. I don't think I know anyone that has been on a team that hasn't experienced this. Give us a little background, if you could, about why this book came to you and was so seriously important, especially in the workplace today. You didn't write this book thinking, oh, we're going to be here at post-COVID. Because you wrote this book before that.
Oh, yeah.
But boy, you delivered it timely manner. What really got, what was the burr under your saddle to say, I got to talk about this and help some people?
Well, I think it was all of my experience, right? I've been in corporate for 25 years, and I sat down one day and just for fun, I added up all the hours of all the teams I've been on, because I've been on probably my unfair share of teams, and it was well over 10,000 hours of teams. So
wow.
I was someone who happened to figure it out, and the executives always went to me. Whenever there was a team that really needed to be successful, had important results, I was the go-to person to lead that team because I had somehow figured it out. So I got a lot of team assignments, a lot, overwhelmingly amount of team assignments. And I enjoyed it so much that when I decided to go out on my own, I decided to get certified as a professional facilitator. I didn't even know it was a thing. I discovered it, and it was like, oh, my gosh, these are my people. I had a blast doing the certification, and it was things I had already been practicing and now just putting, you know, a certification to it. And so now I have over 10,000 hours working as a professional facilitator. And just what I see from all that experience and all the challenges that I deal with and having people, you know, I was in this one meeting where I had been working with the executive director and he wanted to have this metric session. And he, as always, you have limited time to do it, right? Okay, you have 4 hours. And it was quite a big thing to accomplish. So I had put together this extensive pre-read so we could hit the ground running in this meeting, and I gave it to him to approve ahead of time. Well, within the first 5 to 10 minutes of the meeting, he was all over me for this one comment in the pre-read that he disagreed with. And because of my training as a facilitator, I managed that interaction. And I remember someone coming up to me afterwards like, oh, my goodness. I was amazed at how well you managed that. And everyone stayed engaged. You know, it wasn't this big whole drama thing. And I think that's when I started thinking that, you know, someone does need to write a book about this. And when I, myself, when I look at the books that are out there on teamwork, you know, they're kind of like, do these 5 things and everything will be wonderful. Do these 10 things, everything will be wonderful. And I thought, you know, it's a little more complicated than that. We're still not getting it right. And so I thought with my kind of engineering background, my kind of, you know, you learn to be a problem solver, a troubleshooter, that that might be a valuable approach to help people do a better job with teams. Because I was coming around statistics that 75% of teams fail or don't perform, or 90% of teams. I mean, it's depressing. We've been doing this for a long time. We need to do better, because teams are more and more needed as our world gets more complex and as we get more and more technology that we have to deal with. So, yeah.
Over and over and over again. Thank you for sharing that, because, you know, what I'm really struck by is that we are forgetting the impact and effect on people. And the reason I'm so struck by it, I shared this on an earlier show, that, yeah, and I'm just going to tell everybody now, what do you call that, Benny? Oh, this is a spoiler moment. So if you don't want to hear about the outcome of this, just, like, hit the mute button for a minute. What I was struck by this morning was all of the focus has been on the gymnastics team, right, and Simone Biles. Very little focus on Simone Biles' role of being the supporter, being the leader, being the collaborator. And the reason I'm really struck by it is because the other team members are achieving uber unpredictable results. Now, did we bump a little bit on a couple of the things yesterday? But today, Simone Biles coaching to Jade, you know, Carrie, coaching, let it go. Just do what you need to do. We have the least likely team participant. Honestly, so least likely, they don't even give her the same uniform. You know, she's like the alternate, right? You see her on there. She's got, like, everybody's in the uniform, and she's, like, in a red thing. But not today. And I want to talk about this because you talk about emotional well-being in your book.
Yep.
And you also talk about collaboration. And what happened with this today, nobody's going to talk about Simone Biles' role in up-leveling and uplifting that team.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you about this. This is not a bad team, like right. The public is looking at. But there are moments when each of us are on a team and we're tasting success,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't happen. And I want to ask you, what is the emotional impact of bad teams happening to good people from your perspective?
Yeah, so emotions are such an important part of teamwork. You know, emotions can shut down your performance or they can unleash your performance. And what happens when you're in a team is you have a bunch of different people. They may or may not have known each other before they came together. And even if they know each other, there's so much depth to each person. You can't possibly know everything about a person. You know, they're bringing their accumulated life experiences in their non-conscious brain. It's all there. Everything that happened to them over their lifetime is going to influence how they're going to react to different situations that come up in that team. And what we understand, and when I say we, I don't mean me, I mean neuroscientists and behavioral scientists and other scientists, is that we all have different thresholds when it comes to experiencing emotions.
Yeah.
And I want to particularly talk about the negative emotions, the emotions that can really get in the way of our performance. And these can be everything from doubt to concern to frustration to boredom to anger, you know, a whole spectrum of negative emotions. We all have a different threshold for when that negative emotion starts to interfere with our brain processes. So for one person, it could be a lot lower threshold in a given situation than for another person. But when you hit that threshold and your amygdala gets fired up in the brain, that little almond-sized, you know, piece of the brain, deep in the brain, when that gets fired up, it turns off the prefrontal cortex, which is where all the performance mm-hmm. comes from. That's where the decision-making is. That's where mm-hmm. all your logical thought is, your creativity, all of that. And then that's when bad things happen. And it doesn't necessarily take a lot. I mean, it could be a comment. You didn't even mean anything. And you might not even know someone gets triggered because we also respond differently, right? Some people get you know, fight back and get very, you know, stand up and leave the room, slam the door, whatever. And others get into, like, the passive mode, or they just withdraw, or they get that passive aggressiveness. So, you know, this idea of this threshold is a very sensitive thing in teens. One of the things that really helped me, I got certified in the Foundations of Neuroleadership by the Neuroleadership Institute, and they have this model for emotions that I find very powerful, and they call it the SCARF model, and it's an acronym for the different types of things that can trigger our emotions. So the S is for status, the C is for certainty, the A is for autonomy, the R is for relatedness, and the F is for fairness. And so the way the model works is if I perceive a decrease in my status based on what someone says or what someone does in a meeting, then I'm going to tend to feel negative emotion. Okay, and then you can extend that to the other four dimensions. And on the opposite end, if I perceive an increase in my status, then I'm going to tend to be more engaged and get excited. But we're all unique in terms of what does status mean to me? Or what does certainty mean to me? Or what's my threshold? Yeah.
I love this. I want to talk about this. I'm going to skip break if I could. Okay. Well, I made a reference, and I want to get backed up a little bit because the body of work you have in this book is just brilliant, and you can't really, you've got to read the book to follow it and see how, Dr. Valerie, how you're connecting the dots. But one of the things I alluded to was, I think we were the first company, AT&T, let's call it AT&T Bell Labs. I worked at Bell Labs, but it's all part of that Bell Health thing.
Yeah.
And I think we were the first company to try every assessment form on the planet. So anytime there was an assessment form, people would say, call them because they bring you in. They're going to hire you. Come on in. They love assessments, right? But I alluded to the Myers-Briggs, which... Mm-hmm. was so misunderstood.
Yeah.
But let's bring us to why that tool and other tools are important, because in your book, I started to make a list of all the tools you have in your toolkit that you use, right? And you talk about, you put your score in, you put your Myers-Briggs type in here, I saw it.
ENFJ,
I think you put in.
Right. ENFJ.
ENFJ.
Yep.
I am an INFP.
Ooh, cool.
Ooh, is right. So my point is this.
You're unique.
I was so unique. I scored so high on the introvert scale. They were gone. And this is the misuse of assessments. That's why I want to talk about what you put in the book. Because you put in the book how you use these for understanding self, right? Yeah. The old school version of an INFP is they can't lead anything. So that was that misunderstanding. Let's talk about your tools and the tools in here in self-assessment, because we don't do this enough, and then when we don't do it well. Can you talk about this part of your book? Because I think we need to understand this before you and I can have a conversation about leadership, right?
Okay.
How important are these self-assessment tools, and what has been your experience in having them be the key to truly understanding great team dynamics?
Yeah, so I have found that understanding myself has been really important in order for me to be able to interact with others. So I had, shortly after I found out what my MBTI score was, or I think during the process even, I had that aha moment, like, oh, that's what's happening with Bruce. Oh, my goodness. And it turned out, as a team, we all took it and we all learned our scores.
Yeah.
And it turned out that I'm an N in that second dimension, which is intuitive. And he was an S in that second dimension, which is sensing. And intuitives, we were planning a meeting together, and intuitives in general like to see the big picture, where are we headed, what's the outcome, what are the results, and then you sort of back up and, you know, work out the details.
Yeah, Jamie, you're listening to this?
Sensors want nothing to do with that. They want to know, okay, step one, step two, step three, step four. They think it's a waste of time. You know, it's just a different way of approaching
right.
things. And we were having all-out brawls.
Yeah.
We would get nowhere. We'd meet and we'd just fight the whole time and we'd both leave in a huff. And so then I finally, the next time I sat down with him, I said, listen, I need to understand this, where we're headed, before I can sit down and put together the details. It's just the way my brain works. And then we were fine.
Yeah.
You know, it was just understanding that kind of difference, the way we approach things. So I think it's a really critical part of collaborative intelligence. And in fact, there's a great book. I don't know if you know the book Collaborative Intelligence by Donna
yes.
Markova and
yeah.
Angie
Good
MacArthur.
Book. Yeah.
And they talk about thinking talents. And that's another form of self-assessment, is understanding your thinking talents, understanding other people have other thinking talents, and then how can you, you know, work together to leverage your individual thinking talents and not get into miscommunications because of it. So I think that sort of self-assessment helps you to bridge some of the differences and the different ways we approach things. I think they're really valuable for that and a really key part of being a good collaborator.
Yeah, I'm revisiting all of this, and that's why picking up your book and reading it was so important, because we've expanded our team here. I wanna take a look and take a short break here coming up, because one of the things that I want to do is I want to talk about, you know, how this understanding of oneself, regardless of what the outcome of a team is, if you understand yourself,
right.
what could that mean to your own personal effectiveness? Now, I will say that what I learned about myself is that the impact I had, and this is a simple example, you know, as a manager and an executive and a director, you know, when your people come in and you're like 7 o'clock in the morning, you're in, your door is shut if you're me, because you are that person that needs that time to dot, dot, dot.
Right.
What I learned is that view was unapproachable. So rarely is my door shut even today, right? And as a matter of fact, what will happen here is my door is so open, Linda will come three doors down, especially like if I'm on a call or something. Linda will come from three doors down and come up and pull my door shut. That's how open it is. But what does all this have to do with how you move forward? Now, three things I want to say and then we'll come back. One, there are many teams we're on. If you're part of a family, you're part of a team.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that right out of the gate. For those of you out there thinking this is not for me, yes. Two, what Dr. Valerie is doing by having us look at ourselves, you can then do what she just did, what I do, troubleshoot it. On Friday, I went into the staff's room, our producers, there are four of them, we moved our production, and I put this white paper all up on a board. It's all on the wall. I got white paper all on the wall because I'm trying to understand the impact on processes of our new technology, and I have to see it. But Linda, who is more like the SJ, like all in the detail, who gets it, you know, I have to explain why I have to see the connections of the big picture.
Yeah.
It is so important to me, yet it is certainly not important to people that are doing day-to-day. When we come back, how do we explain ourselves? Maybe it's not a good idea to go in four people's rooms and put white paper on a board without at least having them know what the heck you're doing. But more importantly, if you understand yourself, can you understand other team members? And does that buy you anything? Dr. Valerie Patrick is going to talk to us about that. We're giving books away. We're going to take a short break. But before we do, when bad teams happen to good people, there's a lot in here. This is a repair guide for successful teams. It doesn't matter what team you're on.
But 1-800-930-2819, if you've got questions, want a copy of the book, 1-800-930-2819. We're going to talk about assessments, and then we're going to talk about leadership. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Life can be demanding, but sometimes our wheels are spinning and we're too focused on making them turn to notice we're stuck in the mud. Tune into The Pause with me, Ellen Wyoming Deloy, every second and fourth Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific on Transformation Talk Radio. Learn how to stop, reflect, and start moving forward with intention. And if you're really looking to jumpstart your personal development, schedule a free coaching consultation with me at ellenwyomingdeloy.com.
Are you ready to put down that drink or drug for good? Are you struggling to maintain your recovery from addictive behaviors? Do you need help with a family member or loved one who's in early recovery or battling addiction? Get the help and guidance you need by arranging a recovery recharge phone session with me, Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, certified life and recovery coach. Call 1-800-889-1757. Make an appointment today or go to my website, pushybroadfromthebronx.com, and click on the link that says Recovery Recharged. Don't wait. Get the help you need today. This is Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Jennifer Noel Taylor on the hit show Quantum Touch Radio, supercharging your life on TransformationTalkRadio.com. You'll take a quantum journey as well as reveal powerful yet simple steps to create more abundance, better health, emotional and mental vibrancy, and happier relationships using universal quantum touch principles. For more information, visit QuantumTouch.com. Did you know that each Enneagram type has a different worldview, different patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving? They also have essential qualities that are unique to their type. Understanding this helps us develop more tolerance, respect, and appreciation for ourselves and others. Renee Siegel works with individuals, couples, families, and groups using the Enneagram to build better relationships as a tool in addiction recovery. Visit urpurepotential.com for more info.
It's time to shake out your money-making truth on Soul Wisdom Abundance with Jennifer Bloom, creating wealth from spiritual health on TransformationTalkRadio.com. This hit show is more than your roadmap to success. It's your compass to abundance, your joy, and ease. Jennifer Bloom teaches you about the soul's relationship to money and wealth and how improving that relationship serves both you and the world. Learn more at JenniferBloom.com.
Oh, that's a team. Fleetwood Mac. They're a team, Benny.
Of course they are.
Oh, you think they're a team?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Benny, who's the leader of the Fleetwood Mac team?
Oh, come on. You're going to ask
somebody.
That. What? Really?
Come on. So you tell me who you think the leader of Fleetwood Mac team is.
Well, it's got to be Stevie.
What did I say? And guess what? You know, the real leader of Fleetwood Mac didn't agree with that. I think that's why they weren't Fleetwood Mac anymore. Just saying.
It's okay. They're still doing great now.
Oh, my gosh. You know, come on, Stevie Nicks. Thank you for being you. Welcome back, everybody. I want to thank, you know, Dr. Valerie Patrick for being herself, but also being someone that not only understands the power of looking at this, but how to troubleshoot it, how to pinpoint. This book, and Jamie, I know you're putting some pictures of it, When Bad Teams Happen to Good People. This is the kind of book you really need to get for your team and for yourself. 1-800-930-2819. I was reading your book, and I just, out of reading your book, I'm like, I got to make a few adjustments for myself here for who I got to make an adjustment. Yeah. Because you've got to learn some things. You can teach old dogs new tricks.
Absolutely.
I know that. I had an old dog. I taught my old dog new tricks. But I think what you're trying to help us with is you got to build foundational baseline, and that is understand who you are, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I think, you know, the other aspect of understanding who you are is also understanding your source of motivation. I mean, one aspect of understanding who you are is when you understand who you are, then you understand how others are different than you.
Yeah.
And that's an important baseline for collaboration. But the other aspect of understanding who you are is getting more in touch with your source of internal or intrinsic motivation. What are the things you were put on this earth to do? What are the things that you naturally get excited about? What is the type of impact that you think you're meant to have? So that's the other part of understanding who you are that's really important. Because if you're sitting on a team and you can't see the connection between your talents or the things that you really want to have impact on and what the team is trying to do, it's going to be really hard for you to get motivated to be on that team.
I want to talk to you about motivated to get on the team, and I want to move into a leadership because, you know, there's so many things we can talk about here today, but I'm really struck by your chapter on troubleshooting team composition. But there's a few things to talk about before we get there, right?
Okay.
You talk about, may I read from your book?
Absolutely.
A little bit? Okay. There's one thing you said, I learned from a bad experience, and you talk about this. You learned from a bad experience and have since developed skills needed to be flexible in adjusting a facilitation plan on the fly as needed by participants. Now, I want to go to the next thing. A team leader who must deviate from their meeting plan when the team needs to go in a different direction can feel wrong, which can produce a threat response and lead to negative feelings. So I'm talking about deviating from a plan here, okay? Now, deviating from a plan in the minds of some people is a violation of what they believe somebody is obligated to do.
Hmm.
If a team leader deviates from a plan and you believe the team leader is obligated to provide direction and the plan, then you've just violated a psychological contract. And there's so many consequences from that. I want to ask you, in a high-performance team, you have to make adjustments to the plan.
Absolutely.
And isn't the how you do it more important than the what? I'd like to know your take on that.
I think you nailed it, Dr. Pat. The how is everything. Because if you feel in that psychological contract that you do have that responsibility, you're up there, you're leading, you have to get the plan right. If you get it wrong, that's a problem. You've just failed. And if you view that as a failure, you're going to get in an emotional space that's not going to be helpful for the team moving forward. And with the complexity of the work that we have to do today, to expect that one person can come up with a plan and it's going to be right, that's an unrealistic expectation. And that's part of the reason you have the team. So the leader, I think, needs to have that attitude of bring that straw model forward, right? Do the plan as a straw model. Here's where I think we need to start based on my experience, based on the things that I have done. But the reason I have you, team, is to bring in all your different perspectives so we get the best plan going forward. And as we encounter obstacles or we learn new things to adjust this plan as needed, that's the right attitude.
Uh-huh.
So now you're turning being wrong into an openness to learn and all get better together. So yeah.
I want to talk about this. May I read another thing from your book? I read the book.
Absolutely.
So I apologize if I'm quoting from your book.
No, I love it. It's great.
I want to read something because I so believe this. I believe it at every level. And I also believe that everybody can be a leader and a strong leader. I do believe that.
Me too.
And I think you nailed it before. You got to have the motivation to be that. You say leadership is not for the faint of heart. In addition to internal and external leadership challenges or inherent to leadership, in addition to internal and external leadership challenge or inherent to leadership challenge, you know, internal, external challenges. They're internal to leadership. These challenges occur when the resilience and discipline needed to bear the difficulties, burdens, and loneliness of being a leader are lacking. Yo, like, stop the book. This is a core of failures that could be at catastrophic levels. I'm talking the space shuttle. Hello. Mm-hmm. That was a complete, we can talk about that in another show when you come back.
Yeah.
But you then say, the good news, I got to get to the good news I want you to talk about. The good news is that a leader can employ various tactics to handle the internal, external, intrinsic challenges of leadership. I would love for you to talk about that, because what you're saying is, yeah, even though this is a rough and rocky road, and believe me, as an owner of a company that just went through COVID-19 and figured out how to expand and grow through it, this was no easy feat. Did I do it perfectly? No. Am I still making mistakes with my team? Yes. But please talk about what we do learn here from that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the internal leadership challenges, that gets back to what you were talking about before, what you learn from assessments and what you learn from, you know, what you need to do in a particular leadership position and where you might have skills that you need to develop, that you know you need to develop. So those internal leadership challenges are about doing the assessments, finding the gaps, and then getting the training or reading the book or whatever you need to do to address some of those internal limitations. The external limitations are things that are often things you can't control, things that are in the environment, things that you just have to adjust to. And I think they're similar to the inherent leadership challenges, which you just talked about, you know, that loneliness, that it can be lonely at the top. It definitely can be lonely at the top. And, you know, the pressure, the extra stress that the leader feels in terms of the team. And what I have found in my experience is that, and putting up with, you know, people who are impacted by the team's work complaining about it, or the team members complaining about it, or they're not happy about the direction you're setting, or they're not happy about what's going on, or a new barrier, and you have to, you know, help them get through that. I think it all gets back to that well-being that we talked about earlier. And well-being is so important to build what I call personal resilience. You know, that's the basis of your energy, of your ability to keep going in the face of barriers and negativity. That resilience, we understand a lot now from neuroscience in terms of what it takes to have a healthy brain. And I talk about the SPICE model in the book for wellness, which is an acronym for the five dimensions of well-being. So S is for social well-being. That's about having friends, a network of close friends that works for you. For some people, that's a small group. For other people, it's a larger group. P is the physical well-being. That's your diet, what you're eating. That's high-quality sleep. That's exercise. You know, neuroscientists now understand that our brain works best when we're running away from something. So the cardiovascular exercise is really important to the well-being of our brain. Then you have the I, which is the intangible well-being, and that's about, you know, feeding the soul in a way that can help you be in the present moment when you need to, because our brain can be so easily distracted. Then there's the C for cognitive well-being. People pretty much understand what that is. I like to look at it as use it or lose it. You got to continue to learn to use your brain in order to be able to have your brain functioning at the highest ability. And then the last one's emotional well-being, which we already talked some about, but that's all about being aware of your emotions,
mm-hmm.
but also being able to identify the emotions of others, being able to manage your emotions so they're not shutting down your thinking, and being able to manage the emotions of others so their thinking is not being shut down, because neither would lead to good results when it comes to a team.
That leads me to the next part of your book that I really want you to talk about, and boy, I can't talk about it enough, and that is team climate. You know, let me just jump in here for a minute. I play on teams, and I play on teams. Yes. I have teams here in the workplace, but I also play on sport. I play a sport.
Yep.
And, you know, even though we're watching the sport individually, you're also watching for the first time team events in table tennis. And that's my sport. And I'm on teams. And I have partners, and we're on teams, and we do teams. And I have learned more from recently, before COVID, from playing on a team in that sport, especially from people from other cultures, right? So my women partner is East Indian. My mixed partner is South American Mexican. And then my other partner is Chinese. And so when you put everything together, and my coach is Korean. And so when you put everything together, I learn things.
Yeah.
For example, there's a habit in the sport sometimes where you say you're sorry for missing. You just say it. People say it.
Yeah.
My coach and also Louis is like, stop. Do not do that. I want to talk about climate, because when we win as a team, and that means everybody has to play, and you know, when there is winning as a team, the thing I point to is climate. And I don't know if I'm right at that, but that's what I relate to. And there's confusion between organizational climate and culture. Help us out with this, please.
So the other thing that I just thought of when you say you're sorry, it turns out that women tend to say they're sorry more than men, and we can get more into that as well. So climate versus culture. So the way I like to look at it is, if you think of a tree with roots, you know, deep roots, and then you have the branches and the fruit, you know, above the tree, the roots are the culture. So the culture is the goes way back to when the company was started. In terms of one of the companies I worked for, it all started with their manufacturing expertise, and that's where the power base of the company was. And that's something that's just not going to change overnight, because that is built over years and years and years. It's deep in the roots of the company and who they are. But above ground are the how you experience life in the organization day to day, how you feel when you go to a meeting, when you go to your office with your office mates. It's that day to day feeling. And when we talk about team climate, we're talking about how do you actually feel in a particular team. The climate is something you actually can change, because it's not so deeply rooted in the organization. Those are things that are easier to change. And that's why I think it's important to think about team climate. And I think one of the most important things about team climate, and you alluded to this a little bit, is how included people feel in a team. There's research that's been done by the NeuroLeadership Institute that shows that diverse teams, so they can be diverse in terms of visible diversity, different races, different genders, things like that, and different expertise, diverse teams make better decisions, and that gets back to the challenger that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Diverse teams make better decisions. They have higher innovation than homogeneous teams, but only if all the different perspectives are included, only if there is an inclusive climate. So climate is so important,
yeah,
especially as our workforces get more diverse.
Okay, and that really, do you mind if I keep rolling here? But before I keep rolling, I want to make sure from you, Dr. Valerie, everybody knows about your book, but also how do they find out more about you? Because this is such an important conversation. I just don't want to interrupt it with a break. Please tell me how folks can find out more about you, and more in particular, how do they get to hire you?
Absolutely. So I'm a subject matter expert in teamwork, and I do instructional design and training to help people develop the skills that they need to excel in teamwork. And I also provide professional facilitation, which is hands-on support for teams or events that really need to produce results or have high visibility. And my goal in working with clients is to empower them to maximize performance and results. So you can find out more about me on my website, www.fulcrumconnection.com, or you can connect with me, Valerie Patrick, on LinkedIn. You can follow me on Twitter at Fulcrum Connect, or you can check out my video series on YouTube called The Teamcast.
And by the way, also, if I could, please check on the podcast. If you go to the website, you're going to see science-based business success, which I love that topic. And when I look at this, go ahead and look at some of the things on here. For example, secrets to enabling collaboration in your team. Please, if you need help at your organization, which, boy, many of you have asked me, how do I get help? I'm no longer doing that work, but Dr. Valerie Patrick is, please get her. I wanted to stay with the flow of this, if we could, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
And the reason I want to stay with the flow of this is because part of what I discovered in looking at broken promises and promises in general, an unexpected finding had to do with the lack of a definition on integrity in my work.
Hmm.
And so I was able to then define it based on what people said it was. But I have to ask you about integrity in teams, because I do believe that, and I'm not an expert on this at all. I mean, I've done a little research. That's it. You're the team expert. But what have you bumped into when integrity becomes a thing? And it's one of these words, if I could, where it's squidgy. It's like a squidgy word.
I'm going to ask you to define it for me.
What?
I'm going to ask you to define it for me.
I don't even want to go there, but I will define it for you later on. I'll give you like a research thing, what I found. But from your perspective, it shows up on teams, even if people don't know how to define it. And they say things like, I can't work with a manager I don't respect, or I can't. Help me talk about this idea of integrity. I did a survey. It's in about 50% of vision statements of Fortune 100 companies. But integrity is one of those words that you don't talk about it when you have it. You talk about it when people feel they don't have it.
Yeah, so as you're talking about it, the word that comes to my mind is trust.
Yes. Bingo. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about trust in teams. Because my boss used to say that was a backbreaker. That's a visual.
Absolutely. Trust is essential in high-performance teams, and I think it takes a process to get there. I think there are some exercises the team can do together to help get there, and I think that it's really important when you are talking about trust that you're focusing on the roles and the talents that team members are bringing towards the team objective. So for me, focusing on that team objective and keeping it on that and what people are bringing to the team. Because there's external forces, right?
Yes.
You know, especially in organizations.
Oh.
So you can have someone on the team, their boss may be against what the team's doing, you know, and you don't know, and they're put in this awkward position of trying to keep their boss happy and trying to keep the team happy. So I think there are exercises that you can do to surface some of the challenges of team members, and then everyone, you know, can help people who are in these compromising positions. I mean, it could be that someone's on the team that shouldn't be on the team because of the position that they're in. You know, that could be a possibility.
And by the way, that is one of the hardest places to get to. Can we talk
Absolutely.
About that?
Yeah.
Now, look, if you're me and you're you, and let's say you have people on your team, we have control of certain things.
Right.
Right? But there is this thing that happens on teams, and you address it in the book, right?
Yeah.
Participation suffers from lack of trust, right?
Yeah.
And there are things we have to do. You know, there are design issues on teams. There are all of that.
Right.
Your book really does touch on just about every single thing that could possibly cause a hiccup on a team, but then you come back with the solution. I want to ask you this question in the time we have left.
Okay.
In your opinion, going to kind of put you on the spot here if I could.
Go
Go ahead.
Yeah, go for it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you believe the landscape of teens? I mean, your book will apply across the board. It doesn't matter what this answer is. What you have in this book applies across the board.
Right.
So use it for families, by the way.
Yeah.
In your opinion,
yep.
We are seeing people being asked to go back to normal at work. In your opinion, has the landscape changed for what we need to look at to create high-performance teams post-COVID, or does it really not matter?
No, I think it has. I have talked to some people about the impact of COVID on teamwork, and what I'm learning is all the different ways that people have been misusing Zoom. Just like you can misuse email, you can misuse Zoom.
Texting. You can misuse texting.
Absolutely. It's a technology that is great to enhance your efforts when used properly. But, you know, I'm hearing stories of, you know, bosses calling meetings because they're just checking in on people, making sure they're working. They're concerned about people not working since they're not in the office. And, you know, employees can see right through this. You know, using Zoom to gather information. I mean, there's so much more efficient ways to do that. I think there has to be a renewed respect of in-person interaction, whether it's virtual or actual in-person. It's time-consuming. You're pulling people away from their work. It takes more time when you're face-to-face to work through things. You have to make sure that the benefits of that meeting are going to outweigh all those costs. And that gets back to planning. You know, you really don't want to call a Zoom meeting unless you know how are all the people needed for this meeting. They all need to participate. Why? What is it we're trying to achieve? And then is the time we're putting in worth it for those results and taking those people away from their work and putting their time towards this? And I think that's gotten sloppy over the pandemic. I think Zoom's just been such a go-to. And I'm not being negative on Zoom. I think it's a great tool. But I think that's gotten sloppy, and we have to get smarter and better at calling people together, at using people's time and, you know, pulling them into a meeting. We've got to get smarter about that.
This is really, I think, really the next part of one of our greatest challenges and opportunities, because you're absolutely right about it. You know, in our industry and what we've been in, and especially when you're building a network that has hosts participating from all over the world, Zoom is a blessing. And yet I will tell you this, that we are getting more requests now from our hosts that want to come here and do shows from our studio here. And, you know, that's not because they have nothing better to do, but we miss that contact. We miss that contact. But you touched on something really interesting, and I have a few minutes left and I really want to go through. You asked me to define integrity. And I got to a point in my study where there is the qualitative research in this study has 1,200 pages of notes.
Wow.
But one of the unexpected results was that people were wanted to talk about what they called integrity. And so you nailed it. It's so much about trust. But it's really this interesting now definition. When your boss kind of creep zooms you, I call it creep zoom. Sorry.
I like that.
It's creep zoom. When you get a creep,
that's good.
I'm telling you that I have some people that told me their bosses want to Zoom on all the time. I mean, it's creep Zoom. It's like creep Zoom.
Yeah.
Here are some of the things I would love for you to talk about in high performance team. No hidden agendas. Trust between everyone. Be honest and upfront. Responsibility and accountability. Withholding information was literally called a form of dishonesty, right? Not having answers.
Yeah.
But one of the people said this, you need to say what you're going to do and then do it. If something changes, help explain it to employees so they understand why you can count on it. Something happened as promised. If you make a promise, keep it. If something doesn't work out, talk about it honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's transparency.
Yep.
That's transparency for the good of the organization
yep.
and for the good of the team.
Yep. And that's why I want to ask you on this last point to talk about transparency. It's one of the most popular words that came up from our political arena.
Yeah.
The transparency in the workplace, I think, is the work, the body of work that, boy, you can help some companies do. Talk about the importance, if you would.
Yeah, I think transparency is the basis of trust. Mm-hmm. And it comes from a place of wanting, of genuinely wanting to make a positive contribution, of wanting to see success in the organization. It also comes from a place of setting your own goals aside, I think. So you need to be aware of what your ambitions are, but I think you also need to be aware of that you're only going to be able to achieve your ambitions through others. And that's where transparency becomes so important, because organizations, why do we have organizations? Because one person can't do it alone. You need a group of people to do it, and you need to have them structured in a way that everything's going to work out and everything's going to get done. And in order for a person to ascend in an organization, this is more important. I think this is more true today than it used to be the case, because things are more complicated today. You have to be able to work with people in a positive way that to have that impact, to get those results. And transparency is just such an important part of that. I mean, when you think about all the examples of when do you not trust someone, you know, you mentioned the hidden agenda. That's a lack of transparency problem. When you don't understand someone's behavior, okay, something's going on there. You have to unearth what's behind that behavior in order to get to a productive interaction and collaboration. So I'm not saying transparency for transparency's sake. Again, I'm saying transparency when it relates to achieving an objective and the types of the plan, you know, the process that you need to get there or the climate that you need to support that. You know, there's so much research about the importance of climate to innovation and creativity. So transparency with respect to what is needed to support the achievement of the outcomes, the achievement of the results in that group of people, in that team.
You know, there's so much that you've included in the book, and I want to thank you for stepping out and really, you know, helping us understand not just the dynamics of a team, but reminding us that there are human beings on teams.
Absolutely. I really, my goal in writing the book was to help empower people to have good team experiences and to have higher performance, because that's the way you increase your impact and your performance is through others. It's through teamwork. It's so important.
Mm-hmm. Please tell folks again how they can find out more about you. Also how they can get copies of the book. And then I would love to know your personal message, what you'd like to leave us with today. And thank you for taking time to join us on the show.
Oh, absolutely. So, again, my website, www.fulcrumconnection.com. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn, Valerie Patrick. You can follow me on Twitter, @FulcrumConnect. And I also have that video series on YouTube called The Teamcast.
Thank you. Personal message.
Yeah, I think my personal message is that anyone can be a team leader. Anyone can help a fledgling team. I think you just need to learn more about the types of things that can go wrong and the symptoms when things aren't going well. And the book provides all sorts of tactics for you to start with to help you fix your team or to help get you on the right foot if you are a first-time team leader. So I'm go team.
Well, thank you very much. I don't care what you say, but there's nothing that's going to get done in the world as we move forward as organizations without strong teams. It's just not going to happen. those teams that can do the things in your book and can troubleshoot the things in your book, they will be the ones that have insight in order to grow, because that's what teams do. They grow and they change. And you've laid this out beautifully. And I'm not kidding, Dr. Valerie, about this. When I looked at your book and I started to think about some of the family structures, people I know and families, and really what they're struggling with, you really do have a way to help those people navigate through some very uncertain times. And I want to thank you for doing that. I hope I just didn't give you a whole new body of work to do.
Bless you, Dr. Pat. I really appreciate that input and feedback, and it's wonderful. I'm glowing.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
Happy Monday. It's Eric Reiner here with you on KKNW. We are approaching noon. Time for a quick look at our freeways. I-5 southbound, the off-ramp from 164th Street Southwest. There's the collision partially blocking the ramp. We're finding some hesitation southbound I-5 from North Gateway on down to Lake City Way, and 405 southbound, finding some congestion around 520. And again, around Northeast 44th. Make sure you stay tuned for Wisdom from the Wardrobe, brought to you by Michael Bruce Image Consulting, coming up after the news and weather. Right now, 75 degrees with hazy skies here in the Puget Sound. Expecting it to get up to about 86 today, and we'll see sunset tonight at 8:42 p.m.
This report is sponsored by Muckleshoot Bingo.